Good afternoon, everybody. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS. I really think I should begin by saying thank you to our Japanese friends who are here today for giving us the cherry blossoms. Isn't it lovely today? Hasn't it been? It's just spectacular, and it just makes this such a lovely city. And when I think it's 100 years ago that our Japanese friends made this possible and totally transformed Washington for the better. So I just want to say thank you. We have a wonderful opportunity this afternoon. First of all, I welcome Tanaka-sensei back. He became quite a close friend, a friend of CSIS, and I'd say personally, during the time when he was in Paris leading the International Energy Agency, did a spectacular job and a very important time for the global community to understand nuclear issues. And, of course, returned to his native and beloved Japan just at a time when Japan was going through this wrenching, you know, traumatic experience of Fukushima. And this has just made such... it's hard to point to something more pivotal, you know, in global perceptions. And, President Obama recently talked about pivoting to Asia. Well, there's a different kind of pivot on nuclear energy, you know, and that is the previous nuclear states are pivoting away from nuclear energy while most of Asia is pivoting toward nuclear energy. If you really look at it, you know, we've seen an expansion of commitments to build nuclear power in the world since Fukushima, but not in the developed West. And that raises some big questions. That really raises some big questions. We were the architects of a global system of safety and security and economics for nuclear energy. And are we going to be able to retain that role if Germany abandons nuclear energy, if America decides cheap gas lets us abandon nuclear energy, if our Japanese friends decide they don't want to restart reactors? I mean, what's the nature of this global system of security and safety we all need? You know, I think this is the scale of importance of this day. And I think, without exaggeration, that the next 2 years are going to be the most pivotal time when it comes to the future of nuclear energy, around globally and certainly here. So we need to understand that. We need to have a strong debate and dialogue. We need to be informed, not by just our fears, but also our judgment and perspective. And we're going to try to do that today with these three wonderful panelists. Jane Nakano is really running this thing, but I just had to come here and first of all say thank you to you for coming. Thank you to our panelists for being here. And ask all of you to commit yourself to work on this issue. These next years are going to be pivotal. Very important, and we have to get it right. We can't afford to drift into a world that we're going to hate in 20 years. And that could happen if we're not thoughtful about where we're heading. Jane, why don't you introduce this panel, and let's get this started for real. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Dr. Hamry. Hi, I'm Jane Nakano. I'm CSIS Energy Program Fellow, and it's my... great honor to have three distinguished speakers today, since they have very long and impressive resume, but they're all in the handout, so I do invite you to read them after the event. But quickly, I'd like to make an introduction. To my immediate left is Nobuo Tanaka. Mr. Tanaka is, as you all know, was the executive director of IEA in Paris until 2011. He's also the CSIS senior advisor. We're very honored. And he's also the global associate for the energy security and sustainability with the Japanese Institute for Energy Economics that's based in Tokyo. And to his left is Commissioner Bill Magwood. He's the commissioner of the United States Nuclear Regulatory Commission since April 2010, I believe. And to his left is Ms. Leslie Palti-Guzman. She's an analyst with Eurasia Group, and she specializes in global energy and natural resources. And three speakers will talk about key trends that have arisen since Fukushima, since the 3/11 natural disaster in Japan. And without further ado, please welcome Mr. Tanaka. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Thank you, Jane, for providing me the great opportunity. I'll talk 15 minutes. Yes, as a executive director of the IEA, I came to the CSIS in many occasions talking about especially the World Energy Outlook, which is an annual event of the IEA, and make always a release in this organization. And I'm very much honored that I was provided an opportunity to serve this institute as a senior advisor also. So I was looking for the opportunity of coming back, but I didn't find so far. But this annual, about a year from the catastrophe in Japan, this is a great opportunity to review the current situation in Japan and also future prospect. And what does this mean for the global context, and especially Asian energy security? I am now trying several ideas which I disclose with you today and get your reaction for that. Because this is not only Japanese issue. This Fukushima has impacted everybody, and it impacts to the different part of the energy sector. So I'm using the IEA World Energy Outlook from in different pages, but just try to find how this impacts to the year of so-called the most uncertain year this year. It's not mean, I don't mean the election of the United States president, but there are plenty of uncertainties happening. One uncertainty is the growing Asia economy. Is China continue to grow? This is the big uncertainty which we are now facing. Yes, most of the energy demand comes from Asia. This is a World Energy Outlook basic scenario, new policy scenario. China, India, and ASEAN countries will cover about two-thirds of the demand growth of energy. And very interestingly, very peculiar nature of Asian import of oil is, again, the issue. China, India, ASEAN in the 2035, as you can clearly see that China is already the world largest energy consumer, but will be the largest oil consumer also in 2035. While United States import will decline, thanks to the so-called tight oil, and it's a shale oil, so U.S. no longer needs to import oil from Middle East in 2035, while China, India, ASEAN, there's a big fight for oil in 2035. So energy security, especially oil security issue, is an issue for Asia. So how we make the energy security framework in this context for Asia? Chinese growth. Now, when Zhao announced that this year's growth rate of China will be 7.5%, very low relative to the past. Yes, this chart, which was quoted in the 2007 World Energy Outlook about 4 years ago, when I first started, I found this graph very interesting. Chinese economic growth has been maintained very long. When to slow down is a huge issue. It changes all the perspective of any projection. Yes, economic growth, demand for food, demand for energy, you name it. This is the biggest uncertainty when China may slow down. It may be happening. So this is, again, a very interesting but biggest big uncertainty which we are now facing. Another uncertainty is in the producer country. Yes, this is a chart which I picked up from the World Energy Outlook again. This gives you the kind of break-even price of oil for production, that's a blue line, blue part in the bottom. But important thing is, which is the break-even price for budget balance? And for Saudi, it is about even $90 to $100 per barrel. So means that, yes, thanks to the Arab Springs, there are plenty of need for Saudi kingdom to pay the huge social cost and to balance this cost. The price of oil should be high. Means that, yes, still the volatility of the price or higher prices is the way we have to see in the future. Uncertainty number three, yes, golden age of gas is still there. Hopefully, yes, U.S. shale gas revolution is still there, even with some problems of environmental nature, but probably it will continue. But it depends on China also. Chinese demand will increase by 5 times, import increase by 20 times. So how China is going to use this gas will decide the nature of the gas market globally. Where the Russia is getting very important in Asia, because still we are living in the big, fossil fuel economy, and they are going to export much more to East. That means China, Asia Pacific, etc. And their production also comes from East rather than West. So how they diversify the consumer is a very important Russian energy security issue, but what does this mean to the Asian users? Uncertainty number five, that's the nuclear, yes. What is the incident of Fukushima will cause us to? IAEA's low nuclear case clearly mentioned that the impact is we are going to spend lots of gas, lots of coal, lots of renewables if nuclear is much less available toward the future. That means we need two Australia to support this amount of increasing coal. We need one Russia for supporting the increase of gas. We need five Germany to support these renewables to match the increased demand. That means much more costly and also much more less sustainable by more CO2 emission. Germany decided to phase out nuclear after Fukushima, but they need more gas probably. Even 116 billion cubic meters of gas import must happen to sustain Germany. On top of that, Germany has the big network which they can buy electricity from their neighbors. This is the big issue compared to Japan. Lessons from Fukushima. I think Mr. Magud will say much on this. I don't want to waste your time, but Fukushima accident was definitely the human error. So it should have been avoided. That is what Mr. Hatamura, the chairman of the government surveillance commission, said. And why it was human error, we have to see where the error occurs. Tsunami was not expected enough. Plant blackout was not well planned. We have to change total mindset. But the lesson should be much more focused on why it happened to Fukushima Daiichi. Onagawa, it's the power plant much north, but closer to the epicenter was safe because it was planted or built 10 meters higher from the concern of tsunami. There's another plant, Fukushima Daini, which was okay because newly built and their emergency pumps are covered by building. There's another one, interesting, a little south in the Ibaraki Prefecture, which is Tokai Daini plant. Their emergency electricity or pumps were covered successfully just a matter of a day or 2 days before tsunami. And they escaped catastrophe. So depending on the power plants, their measures and their response to the risk was different. Why? Why Fukushima Daini didn't do their necessary job to avoid this occurrence? So this must be the very important lesson which we have to learn, or world must learn, and to avoid the same repetition of the mistake which we made. So for that, we need more international collaboration. Yes, we need independent regulatory commission like NRC should be implemented in Japan. There are plenty of institutional regulatory things we have to improve, and international collaboration is necessary. Yes, we know that NRLC has suggested many things to Japanese authority, which unfortunately we ignored, and we caused catastrophe. So there are lessons and responsibilities we have to clearly do in the future. Uncertainty number six, power grid and renewable energy. Yes, Germany can phase out nuclear because of their connection to their neighbors, but not Japan. Japanese electricity system is almost divided into two markets, depending on the frequency. By the way, this is a fact which IEA has been warning Japan for years, more than 10 years. If some emergency happens, Japan would suffer seriously. Unfortunately, this warning was right and true, and Japanese government ignored and paid the huge cost of doing that, unfortunately. So now the unification of this market is on the agenda by different methodologies, but without that, we cannot really enforce the security. Without that, we cannot really creating the market for variable renewables, because variable renewables need much more wider or larger market to balance the changes. Renewables is very costly. Just I don't want to get in. Their feed-in tariffs will start in Japan in July this year, but this will give much higher cost of electricity. Yes, and this is an interesting chart. What is the IEA is telling us, what kind of percentage technically possible for the different countries of using renewables in their generation portfolio. Japan is just 19%, while Denmark can generate 63%, because they are much more flexible in nature and connected to their neighbors. So if there is excess electricity, Denmark can export it to their neighbors like Norway, while Japan cannot. So this is the very important lesson and requirement for the Japanese to use more renewable energy sources in the future. It's not only feed-in tariff, but design of the electricity market is really necessary to utilize more renewables. The United States, same thing. Where unbundling happens, like Texas, has much more networks and using renewables more. Rather, they have the excess to export to California, not the case in Carolinas. Uncertainty number seven is sustainability. I don't want to spend too much time, but to achieve this 450 ppm scenario at 2 degrees Celsius, we need more technologies, and coal is going to be a big issue. Coal reduction, consumption reduction should happen to achieve this sustainability. Again, CCS is very important, but very costly. What is the security, energy security for 21st century? My point is that, yes, 20th century is the age of cheap oil and automobile. So security of petroleum is the core of the security of energy. Buy the strategic stockpile. That is one way to secure the supply. And for that, IEA was created. But future is more electricity. So how to supply electricity in a stable manner, in a sustainable way, by different sources like gas, coal, and renewables, nuclear, or more efficiency? So this is the challenge. So different country has different portfolio. Europe has very different portfolio each other, like Poland with lots of coal. Germany is well balanced. France is depending on nuclear. But as a whole, as an average, second from the bottom, EU27, the self-sufficiency is 50% and very much well diversified to renewables, fossil fuel, and nuclear, because they created one big market by connecting each other. This is a European model of energy security and sustainability. And my point is, why not in Asia? This is the strategic stockpile of oil for IEA. The red part is their, weight in the global market. because of the consumption is reducing in these countries, certainly the weight of IEA stockpile is declining. Means IEA's relevance in terms of the influence to the market is declining, while China, India is increasing. China is interested in building another IEA under their leadership, because they are not ready to join IEA, which is created by the United States. This geopolitics of system of petroleum security should be modified or extended or strengthened. This is a very difficult political decision we need to do in the future. Gas security, yes, gas supply is much more pipeline oriented with LNG. Russian pipeline is much more to the west at this moment, but why not east? I am saying that if nuclear power cannot be applicable so much in Japan, we need gas from Russia through pipeline. Does this change geopolitics between two countries? Maybe, which was the case between Germany and Russia, and east part of the Germany came back eventually. Why not northern territory backing to Japan if we can change geopolitics between two countries? Can U.S. accept this? China is certainly has a lot of concern of their sea lane and pipelines in the future. South China Sea, East China Sea is their very strong interest. How can make the energy security framework of this with China, with Russia, with Japan, with ASEAN countries? This is a very interesting area which we want United States should play very important role. What role? I don't know. But this is a very challenging. Europe and North Africa is connecting each other by so-called desertic visionary project of connecting grid lines of using renewables of North Africa to Europe. ASEAN has the same idea. And there is a Japanese businessman, Son Masayoshi, is trying to build Asian super grid connecting Mongolia to Japan, Russia to Japan. Russia wants to sell electricity to Japan rather than gas. Can we proceed on this? This will change East Asian energy security substantially, but 21st century security is more collective energy, electricity supply security. If that's the case, this may have some meaning. Last uncertainty is, can we continue to invest? Politics changes from time to time, on and off and on and off of energy infrastructure create the investment very, very difficult. So we need $39 trillion from now to 2005. Who will pay for this investment under this uncertainty? Big challenge. Well, this is the last chart, but I thank you, because we need a good cooperation between Japan and the United States. And sometimes the plan for the Asia, we need good U.S. involvement. We want to make this comprehensive energy security framework just like EU, but maybe slightly different, because they're a huge producer of oil or gas or hydro, like Russia. Maybe the LNG from United States exported to Japan could be a very interesting idea for the security alliance. Yes, we have to work closely with you on the nuclear power, technology development for security, but in all that, the challenges here and uncertainties here, that we can work together, but we want to see clearly the direction of joint venture in the future for that security, energy security for Asia. And I really thank you for today of listening to me or providing me the opportunity to ask the question, how can we build the future together? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tanaka. And may I invite Commissioner Magwood next. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Well, first, let me thank Mr. Tanaka for his remarks. It's been a while since I thought about this, but before I left DOE, I was chairman of the Nuclear Energy Agency's Steering Committee on Nuclear Energy, and I think I was leaving that position just about the same time that he was taking over at the IEA, so we never had a chance to interact very much, but I did know that you were on the job at IEA and appreciate your service to your national community during that period. Thank you. Well, let me begin by talking a little bit about the agency that I am currently attached to, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Just to give you a little bit of background, the NRC basically is a grandchild of the Manhattan Project. You know, after the Manhattan Project, the United States formed the Atomic Energy Commission, which was a very large, very powerful organization that controlled everything from nuclear research to nuclear weapons and nuclear regulation, medical uses of radiation. Everything was encompassed in the AEC. That power actually became somewhat controversial by the early 1970s, and as a result, Congress decided to split the agency into two pieces. One piece, which is was considered to be more promotional to nuclear energy, was IRDA, the Energy Research and Development Administration, which ultimately became DOE, and another piece, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, was created with a culture of independence with a focus on nuclear safety, and that really is the culture that NRC has today. It's an organization, a very large regulator, 4,000 people across the United States. We have we're headquartered outside of Washington, D.C. About 1,000 of our staff are scattered around the country. We have four regional offices, and we also maintain a presence of at least two people at every nuclear power plant in the country, which is an incredible asset for us. But our singular focus is nuclear safety. And as I think you heard from Mr. Tanaka's remarks, the independence of the NRC is really considered to be one of its principal strengths, and I'll talk a little bit about that as I go on. But, you know, since I've been with the agency, one of the things that we've had to realize is that our normal everyday work isn't what really tests us. It's really the unexpected. And last year was full of unexpected things. You know, for example, here's a picture of one of our nuclear power plants imitating an island in the middle of a lake. This was a Fort Calhoun plant. As Missouri River rose, you know, we had to react to the fact that this had happened and deal with the consequences from that. This reactor is still shut down. We also had a small hurricane blow up the northeastern coast, and that affected several nuclear power plants. We had to respond to that. This is a photograph from our Emergency Operations Center. As soon as the hurricane was approaching, we activated the Emergency Operations Center, and we sent inspectors to various plants to see if they were prepared for the incident. And we also had an interesting earthquake last year that affected several plants and led to one being shut down for an extended period, the North Anna plant in Virginia. That ultimately was restarted. But these were incidents that there was no preparation for. Well, there's preparation that we do for all things, but there was no expectation that these things would occur. Now, one of the things that for me was actually quite interesting about these events is that very common when nuclear plant is or challenged by one incident or another, it usually shows up in the trade press, but it doesn't normally receive much attention from the general public or from the broader media. On these occasions, on every one of these, there was significant reporting from both the national press, local press, the broad popular media actually noticed it, the public noticed it, and took great note of it. And I think that it's really very easy to understand why that would be, because all these incidents happened after this incident. What Fukushima, I think, taught the public more than anything else was something that we know quite well in the nuclear business, which is that natural disasters can impact nuclear power plants. You can compromise a nuclear power plant if you have a sufficiently large natural event. And I don't think that the general public really thought about that in any real detail before this incident. But obviously, we saw the situation unfold on television, and that's another great thing about television. You get to see things happen in real time and watch bad things happening, and that happened certainly in the case of what happened in Japan. Now, before I talk about the incidents, I think it's worth backing up a little bit and thinking about what this really means from a policy standpoint. In Japan, nuclear power was a very important part of the energy mix. This graph shows what the energy mix looked like in 2008, showed about a quarter of Japanese electricity coming from nuclear. By 2010 or so, that percentage was up to about 30%, and the Japanese had expected to reach 40% by 2017 with the addition of new units. And the Fukushima site in particular was a very important aspect of that. It's a very large plant, six boiling water reactors, about 4,700 megawatts of capacity. Most of that electricity, by the way, was shipped south to Tokyo. And it was such an important facility that TEPCO, the operator, Tokyo Electric Power Company, had planned to construct two new advanced boiling water reactors, the same technology we're evaluating in the United States, to increase their capacity. So this was a very, very important site for Japan for a number of reasons. And so when we saw the incidents of the flood, the tsunami striking, and this is a picture from one of the administration buildings. I mean, many of you have seen the damage. Here's a picture of the water pouring through the site, and of course the aftermath has been well seen. You know, as I put it, this was a very bad day at the plant. It had a very large earthquake, 9.0 magnitude earthquake, followed by a 15-meter tsunami that overwhelmed the systems on the site. And Mr. Tanaka talked about some of the issues associated with that. This led to a condition called an extended station blackout. And it's, and for those of us who work in the nuclear field, this is really sort of the classic scenario for failing a nuclear power plant. If you want to see a nuclear power plant run into trouble, just take all the power away, on-site and off-site, and that's what happened. And really what happened after that was really pretty predictable. There really weren't very many surprises at that point. Nuclear power plants in all over the world, beyond both the AC power they use from off the grid and their diesel generators, also have batteries. And the Japanese plants had batteries that lasted, but around, we're still not completely sure about this, I think it's about six to eight hours. But eventually that power ran out, and the cooling systems failed, and that led to the core damage and the hydrogen explosions that all of us saw on television. And so the rest of it's actually, I think you know. Now, when the incident took place, we immediately activated our emergency operations center, and we ended up staffing that center 24 hours a day for 9 weeks, monitoring both the unfolding incident, looking for, in the early aspects of this, looking for impacts on health and safety in the United States, and but eventually also monitoring the situation at the plant to provide assistance to Japan. We also dispatched experts to Tokyo essentially right away. Within 24 hours of the earthquake, we had two people en route to Tokyo, and by the end of the weekend, as you recall, this took place on a Friday, we had 11 people in Tokyo at the U.S. Embassy supporting the Japanese activities. We coordinated environmental monitoring with the Department of Energy and EPA, and we also launched a series of inspections with our own nuclear power plants to check to make sure that they were up to spec on all the responses that they should have in case of a natural disaster, to make sure that the procedures were in place, that the equipment was in place. So that was one of the first things we did. And we also launched what we call the near-term task force to analyze Fukushima's events and to look at the U.S. regulatory infrastructure to see if any changes need to be made. And I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail. But NRC was not the only organization in the U.S. government to take response. I'm quite proud of the fact that the U.S. government rose to the occasion. The president made it very clear very early on in the incident that whatever assistance Japan needed, Japan was going to get from the United States. And essentially every aspect of the U.S. government that could play a role did play a role. Many of these agencies dispatched people to Japan, provided equipment, provided advice, provided whatever assistance was necessary. In particular, we're very proud of the role that the military played, the assets of the U.S. Navy in Japan, aircraft carriers, helicopters, personnel, were used not just, certainly not just for the radiological aspect, but really largely for disaster assistance after the tsunami. And we're quite proud of the fact that the U.S. government stepped up and took on such an aggressive role to support the Japanese people. So whenever something like this happens, you know, there's always the discussion about what do we learn from this. And whenever you look at particularly a nuclear incident, be it Chernobyl or Three Mile Island or anything else, there's always very detailed technical lessons that are learned about procedures and technologies and processes and other aspects of the incident. But I think it's more important really to focus on what I call the big lessons. And I think that all major incidences that we've seen over the years have big lessons to tell us, and I think it's important we listen. And quite frankly, the most obvious of these big lessons from Fukushima is understanding the risks facing each plant. And this was something that I know that there's been a lot of discussion about in Japan about whether the Fukushima was prepared for an appropriate size earthquake, for the appropriate size tsunami. That discussion still goes on, but that's something we see is very important. If you're going to build a plant, you have to understand what the environment is. But at the same time, you also have to recognize that sometimes nature is unpredictable. Sometimes, no matter how careful you are, no matter how much analysis you do, you will be surprised. You will get an earthquake that's bigger than you expected. You will get a flood that's higher than you expected. You'll get a hurricane that's more powerful than you thought. So the principal lesson for me from Fukushima is recognizing that recovering from disaster quickly is at least as important as preparing for disaster in the first place. And a lot of what we have been doing at NRC in the last several months has been focused on that aspect of it. And one big lesson I think is worth pointing out, because it stands out so prominently, is, and this is one in the United States we really hadn't given a lot of thought to, is that there is a potential for common cause failure of both on-site and off-site AC power that could lead to a station blackout. The way our regime is structured in the U.S., we've always assumed that if something were to happen with the AC transmission, that the diesels would kick on and we would be fine, and there's lots of history to support that. And if something were to go wrong with the diesels, we'd always have the AC power, and if not one line, it would be another line. So we always had great confidence that we wouldn't lose both all AC transmission and all AC-DC or AC power at the same time. Well, that's exactly what happened in Fukushima. So we're making adjustments because of that. I mentioned earlier the near-term task force. The near-term task force was given a 90-day mission to assess the Fukushima incident and to make recommendations. The task force was staffed by some of our best and brightest at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the bottom line that they reached was, after looking at the incident and looking at the U.S. infrastructure, that there is no immediate imminent threat from the continued operation of nuclear power plants in the United States. In other words, U.S. plants are safe, and we've been very confident about that through all our analysis. We also believe that similar events are very unlikely to occur in the United States. We don't have the kind of geology and circumstances could lead to a large tsunami, but that doesn't mean that we're not worried about natural disasters. We have other threats that we have to worry about. We have to worry about tornadoes. We have to worry about floods. We have to worry about hurricanes. And everyone has to worry about seismic to some degree. So we still have issues, but not quite the same scenarios that were faced by Fukushima. Nevertheless, we already have in place mitigation measures that could reduce the likelihood of core damage. We have put in place since 9/11 special equipment and procedures that can be brought to bear in case of some large site-wide disaster that could be used to prevent a plant from going to a meltdown situation. That's something that is a very important part of our defense in depth. But nevertheless, even after all that was looked at, the task force concluded there were still 12 broad recommendations that they wanted to make to the commission that would further enhance safety. Now, I won't go into this in a great deal of detail, but I will talk about each one of the major elements that we've implemented so far. The commission just a couple of weeks ago authorized the staff to proceed to issue orders, compulsory orders, and also requests for information to implement these various items. One, to reevaluate all the external hazards. We're starting off with flooding and seismic, but we expect to do all external hazards eventually. We're going to do a new rulemaking on station blackout, which will change our rules on how utilities have to respond and prepare for a station blackout. We're adding additional mitigating strategies for not just the design basis accidents, but for beyond design basis accidents. Those are accidents that are bigger than we expected. So we're going to take action there. One very specific technical thing, we're going to require that Mark 1 and Mark 2 reactors, these are the vintage of BWR reactors that were at the Fukushima site, all have reliable hardened vents. And these are vents that will enable the pressure in the reactor pressure vessels to be released safely without compromising safety at the plant. We're also going to require new instrumentation for spent fuel pools. We're going to integrate emergency procedures, lots of different emergency procedures, and we discovered, it was actually kind of an interesting conversation, that while we have all these different procedures, they weren't necessarily talking to each other. So we're going to integrate those procedures. And we're also going to make sure that we're prepared for multi-unit events. Fukushima showed you that you can have six reactors getting a problem at the same time. You have to be ready for that. Now, we don't have six reactor sites, but we do have two and three reactor sites. So it's something that we're going to be looking at. So where do we go from here? Well, in Japan, the work continues. I had the opportunity to visit the Fukushima site in January. And I saw the work that was going on. There are many people who are working hard to make sure the site remains safe, and they're working hard to reduce the release of radioactive material from the site. But this is going to go on for a very long time. This is a very challenging technical matter that the Japanese have to face. There's still a lot of work to be done to analyze the situation at the site to make sure we know where the core melt material has gone and how it behaved. So it'll probably be very likely to be decades before this site's fully remediated. In the meantime, the impact on Japan from a power standpoint has been pretty dramatic. Before Fukushima, there were 54 reactors in Japan providing electricity. Today, two are in operation, and we could very likely be down to zero in just a few weeks. That's an almost unimaginable impact. It's hard to imagine how we would deal with that in the United States, and it's very challenging for Japan, particularly as we move up towards the summer. So this is something that people are watching very closely. Now, in the United States, beyond all the steps that we've taken in the immediate response to Fukushima and the various orders that I described a few minutes ago, there are going to be some very important lingering policy issues that we're going to have to deal with. One that's very prominent, we get to ask this question all the time, are we going to revise our emergency planning requirements? As many of you know, the U.S. uses a 10-mile emergency planning zone model. That doesn't mean that we would only evacuate 10 miles if necessary, but we plan on that basis. And many people have asked, should we not increase that? And if we increase it, should we also make potassium iodide more broadly available to more people? Questions like that abound, and we're going to evaluate this. We'll look at it after Fukushima. a little more esoteric issue is whether we need a new regulatory regime to deal with beyond design basis events. Today, we really classify events at nuclear power plants as either within design basis, which means the plant's designed to deal with it, or beyond design basis, which means the plant was not designed to deal with it. We're now looking at the possibility of having a middle ground, which has been given various names, but generally called something like extended design basis, which would provide some regulatory footprint in incidences that are beyond design basis, but are likely enough to make it worth having some preparation. So we're looking at that possibility. It's low inside baseball, but it has some significant ramifications for the future. But not nearly as big as this one. And this is one that's been giving some prominence, as several people have spoken to this in recent times. Our regulatory regime in the United States is based on the idea that we protect the public. We protect human safety. And part of human safety is if you can get people out of the way of a plume from a from a reactor, you've made them safe. That's part of the defense in depth. But it doesn't look at the socioeconomic impacts. It doesn't look at long-term land contamination. It doesn't look at issues like that. So the question has been asked, and we are going to have to deal with this question, should we adjust our regulatory regime to deal with that? And so that's something that we will be looking at in the coming months and years. And I consider this to be a game changer. This is a very, very big issue that could have serious ramifications for future nuclear power. So it's something to watch very closely. So what we call the nuclear renaissance in the U.S.? Where is that today? Well, the short answer is that Fukushima has had relatively modest impact on plans to build new nuclear power plants in the U.S. The NRC continues to evaluate 10 projects to build new plants. We have already evaluated two. The commission has made a decision on one, which I think you're familiar with, the Georgia Power's Vogtle site. That project is now underway. We announced that earlier this year. There's a second, the Summer site in South Carolina. That is very close to a decision. Expect to see one very soon. But this work continues. These utilities have already done a considerable amount of work at these sites. I believe that they both spent about $3 billion already on these projects, looking for approval. And so that work is continuing. That work has not stopped. Now, there are other projects that I think are waiting in the wings. We'll see where those go. From discussions we've had with the industry, we don't see significant changes from Fukushima. What we do see, though, is some reconsideration based on what our next speaker, I think, is going to talk about, which is very, very low natural gas prices. I think that decisions made about the future nuclear power, be it the large central stations that we are looking at today, or it's the small modular reactors that people are interested in, I think a lot depends not so much on the regulatory and technical issues. I think it depends much more on financial and economic issues, and I think that's really going to determine what the future looks like in the next decade or two. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Commissioner. Ms. Paul T. Guzman, thanks.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much for inviting me. At Eurasia Group, which is a political risk consultancy, we're focusing on geopolitical risk. So as you can imagine, Fukushima gave us a lot of work and new questions from clients, which were very anxious about knowing what is going to be the impact of Fukushima on the different fossil fuel, notably oil, gas, coal, but also on the nuclear market. My expertise is natural gas, so I'm going to focus mainly today on the impact of Fukushima on the global gas market and also looking more in depth on how it has impacted Japan, which is the world's largest importer of liquefied natural gas, because Japan is not connected to any grid, and so no pipeline, so only shipments from LNG can arrive to Japan. So 2011 and the start of 2012, we've seen major shocks in the global gas market. The first one, obviously, was Fukushima, but also the Arab Spring that cut up some supply from Libya to the Italian market, for example, was another big shock in the market. Also, we're continuing to monitor the situation and the stability in Algeria, which is also a big gas supplier to the European market. However, last year, the global gas market has shown a great amount of flexibility because a lot of new supply, notably LNG supply, arrived on the market the 2 years before. So the market was very well supplied, which was a good news for Japan because a lot of suppliers were able to redirect some shipments of LNG to Japan to address Japan's extra need for LNG. Japanese LNG imports are going to remain high this year through spring and summer, and all is going to depend on the timing of the restarts of the first nuclear reactors. Also, another shock has been the Eurozone crisis, which was kind of good news for Asia because it has freed some LNG cargoes from Europe to Asia. Another potential risk of disruption this year could come from Iran that has threatened various times to block the Strait of Hormuz. And if this happened, that would have a terrible impact not only on the oil market, but also on the gas market. Because Qatar, which is the world's largest supplier of LNG, lied on the other side of the Strait of Hormuz. So it would mean that basically 30% of the global gas trade would be paralyzed by a blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. On the supply side of the market, I went too far. Seems that I have an issue with that. Thank you. On the supply side, so as I mentioned, the market was well balanced and well supplied, and one of the main reasons is that North America is now self-sufficient because of the shale gas boom. So what it meant in the past 2 years for the gas market is that all the LNG that was supposed to come to North America has been redirected to Europe, Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. And now we are even talking about LNG exports. There are right now about 8 projects from the US that have been proposed. One has received an approval from DOE, an export license to export to everywhere in the world, not only to free trade countries, but also to non-free trade countries. This is the Sabine Pass project. And we think that from the US Gulf Coast and from the US in general, there would be 3 maximum projects that would be approved for exports based on shale gas, because the U.S. is already an exporter of LNG from Alaska, the Kenai LNG facility. But this is a very small one that it has been opened since 1969, and it closed actually temporarily this year. And also North America includes Canada, which has about 3 proposed LNG export project also. So we are going to see some kind of competition between the US and Canada to export to Asia. The other big supplier, as I mentioned, is Qatar. And right after the Fukushima disaster, Qatar has been supplying about 12 million tons of LNG to Japan last year. So we see that Qatar has become the go-to supplier in time of emergency situation. If you have a shock in the market, you can go to Qatar because they have supply available. And this is like a little bit in the oil market, you're looking at spare capacity. The same way in the LNG market, you're looking at the divertible, flexible supply. And Qatar can provide this. Another big supplier is Russia, which has expanded its export capacity into Europe. And also, what's very interesting is that post-2015, in the second half of the decade, we're going to have many new supply from LNG coming online. And this is from established existing supplier, notably Australia, but also from new unexpected exporter that 2 years ago we were not even thinking about them as exporter of LNG. And I'm talking about North America, Canada, and the US, but also Mozambique that have experienced major gas discovery, also Israel and Cyprus. So we're going to see maybe a glut of LNG supply post-2015, and this can have a huge impact on the pricing of gas. And I'll come back to this a bit later. So the big question and the big unknown right now is the timing of the nuclear restart in Japan. And we believe that, it's going to depend on the prefectural governments that will determine when the operation would resume. And this can happen anytime from 1st of April. But it's not going to be a fast restart. If the decision comes to restart nuclear reactors, it's going to be a slow restart, prefectures by prefecture. So the ramp up of the nuclear power generation in Japan is not going to happen overnight, and Japan will still require extra LNG this year. Also, we believe that in the longer term, nuclear reactors are likely to remain in operation for the next 5-10 years, but down the road, there will be a declining of power generation in the energy mix in Japan. So Japan, in the longer term, will keep needing extra gas. But Japan is not the only one in Asia that has climbing gas demand. And increasingly in Asia, there will be competition also to attract LNG cargoes. So in the past, you had basically in Asia the main established historical LNG importer of Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. Now you have also the booming economies of China and India. And the third big market that has emerged is Southeast Asia. By 2015, I'll show you on this chart, you'll have five Southeast Asian nations importing LNG. And I'm talking about Thailand, Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam, and the Philippines. Also in the Southeast Asia, Singapore has the ambition to become this big LNG trading hub. Singapore is building its regasification terminal, but they are building it much bigger than their domestic need is. And the reason is that they want to attract importers and exporters in the region to use this facility for a trading hub. And they are going to authorize third-party access in the facility, and they are building also increased storage capacity. And increasingly, what you're going to see is the possibility of Singapore to create a second price marker in Asia. Because right now in Asia, you have only one price, which is the JCC, which is the Japanese crude cocktail. And there is increasingly Asian players want an alternative to this oil index price, and they want to create a gas to trade gas indexed price. So Singapore has this ambition, but there are other places in Asia that also wants to create this kind of similar hub. Now let me turn to what was exactly the impact of Fukushima in Japan and how it's changing the mentality and also the government, but also the industry strategy to buy LNG. One of the main concerns right now for Japan is the pricing of LNG. But also, Japan has always wanted to secure stable supply. So how can you strike the balance between reasonable pricing for the fuel and security of supply? The Japanese government is right now devising a new strategy that will be released around the summer, around June, that will state how now the companies are going to be encouraged to buy LNG upstream, meaning they are going to be encouraged to buy equity stakes in upstream projects, whether in Mozambique or in Canada, and be part of all along the LNG chain to bring back the LNG home. But to this end, they will be encouraged to create consortiums to be able to negotiate as a pool, like the different Japanese utilities will pool together to negotiate with the producer to the end of hoping to get more advantageous pricing for the fuel. So in a way, the utilities are going to be competing at home because there will be more liberalization in the domestic Japanese market, but abroad they will be encouraged to cooperate. And the Japanese government is also going to give a special fund to these utilities to buy upstream equity interest and the molecule upstream. There is also talks about negotiations between Japan and Korea to buy together some LNG stakes in upstream projects. So this strategy at the end is going to encourage a diversification of supply and hoping to get as much as possible stable procurement. So I mentioned Canada, but also Mozambique, and I'm going to show you a table actually. I don't know if you can see very clearly, but it's all the future planned LNG projects where Japanese companies are involved. So it's it's Nigeria, but Nigeria's project right now are on hold because the government has not yet decided, has not yet passed the awaiting bill called the Petroleum Industry Bill. But as soon as this bill is voted, and we're hoping on it this year, there will be two new projects, and Japanese companies are already involved in Brass LNG. And then Australian projects, of course, but also Canada, I was mentioning. So Mitsubishi is part of the Kitimat LNG project. Also Russia. There is a new project that has been discussed between a Japanese consortium and Russia called the Vladivostok LNG project. And part of it is a big Japanese consortium called Japan Far East Co. And there are about five Japanese companies involved. And as I was mentioning also, Mozambique LNG, where Mitsui is involved. So all of this, we see that there are new projects coming online, and that will have a tremendous impact on gas pricing negotiations. And those pricing negotiations happen in Asia, but it's also happening in Europe. In Asia, so there is a big push now from Japanese company to start to test the market, whether they can move slowly away from oil indexation. They are going to be very cautious because they are, you know, striking the balance between being sure that the project is going to be built and having the security of supply, and at the same time trying to reduce their trade deficit. This year was the first time where Japan had, in 31 years, a huge trade deficit because of its procurement from and imports on fossil fuels. So there is a big push now and a renewed debate on how to break this oil indexation, which costs so much money to Japan. There are talks about new creative formula, and I think that what we're going to see slowly emerging is that contracts will keep a large portion based on oil indexation, let's say 70%, but the other 30% would be based on the gas indexation. And it can be a North American price index, or it could be an Asian gas price index. So it can be the one from Singapore or one in Shanghai, but like slowly we are going to see the emergence of an alternative pricing in Asia. And those pricing discussions also happen, for example, in China, where they are really now starting a major internal gas reform, and they are testing a new pricing in two provinces. And so this debate on moving away from oil indexation cannot be separated to what is happening in Europe. Europe has been for the past 2 to 4 years in negotiation with its main suppliers, so the big European utilities, ENON, GDF Suez, ENI, RWE, have been in negotiations with Gazprom, Statoil, to renegotiate their long-term contracts, which are also used to be based on pure oil indexation. And increasingly, they managed to get 15 to 20% based on gas spot indexation. So this is a trend that we're seeing, and increasingly, potentially, the U.S. LNG exports or Canada LNG export could have, as an impact, a slow convergence of global gas pricing. And it's going to take some time, but there are some signals and pointers that move into this direction. Thank you.
Thank you so much. The rule for the Q&A part of it is that please wait for the microphone and please identify yourself, your organizational affiliation, and ask the question in the form of question. But I will, if I may, exercise the prerogative as a moderator. I can easily come up with half a dozen questions for each of the speakers, but I'll contain myself to just two. One, the first question is to both Mr. Tanaka and Leslie. Within Washington, D.C., there is starting to be active debates on the rationale or wisdom behind exporting U.S. natural gas overseas. There are all these concerns, you know, how it may impact domestic industries that rely on cheap feedstock, fuels, and et cetera. From where you are, Ms. Tanaka, if, you know, say the Japan side, and of course, Leslie, with your, say, beyond Japan, the global perspective, how big of an uncertainty is this U.S. sort of inside Beltway debates posed to the future of LNG trade?
Well, inside Beltway very often decide the global market, so it's very important. Cool. Japan, yes, as expressed by my colleague, that the LNG importation is the sole importation of gas at this moment. So pipeline alternative could be very interesting with Russia. But LNG, but we need as much diversified sources as possible. So U.S., Canada is probably another very important diversified sources of LNG. The pricing, as she mentioned, converging in the future into the global market. So at this moment, it is very isolated, but eventually the U.S. Market is going to be connected. Another point here is that, yes, under this circumstance that, as Commissioner explained, all the power plant will or reactors will stop in Japan in the end of April or early May. If that happens, and under that circumstance, if Iranian crisis happens and Hormuz Strait blocked or whatever the influence happens, then we will have much more serious impact than March 11. 20% of the gas comes from Hormuz, Kuwait, and Qatar. More than 80% of oil comes through Hormuz. So Japanese economy will have a disastrous impact by together compound catastrophe with Iranian crisis or Middle East crisis with non-reactors running. And unfortunately, Iranian crisis may happen much more frequent than once in 1,000 years like tsunami. So I am asking the Japanese government and politics that this is a very important test of crisis management of our government. And I hope that it is coming. Now the three reactors are almost finished the stress test, and it's going to the prime minister and other ministers' decision. And then, again, the governor must approve these decisions. So still, we have to wait and see, but hopefully the decision will come as early as next month. And in China, I was asked a very interesting question by the former minister. Mr. Tanaka, what will happen to the Japanese nuclear reactors? I think I answered to him that, yes, we will definitely maintain nuclear power. It is very necessary for the sake of energy security for us. No. I don't mean the long term, but short term restarting. Because if Japan is buying more LNG, yes, certainly it has a huge impact to the price. And China is very much concerned of what Japan will do on these reactors. So our decision is not only the Japanese context, but to the, it has the impact to the global market. So as, I think, the LNG exportation from the United States or Canada. So as a global player, yes, we want to see as many suppliers as possible. But for the United States producer to have as many consumers, that is also very important. Diversification is the best way to achieve energy security.
Yeah. So since the U.S. gathered all this amount of shale gas, they have a new issue, which is to find relevant demand drivers. Because the price of Henry Hub, the domestic gas price, is so low that the producer right now don't have enough incentive to keep producing. So there is a wish to find new demand drivers for all this amount of shale gas? And basically, there are four options. The first one could be LNG exports, but they are in competition with other sectors. The other one is the petrochemical industry, which has an interest in seeing the U.S. natural gas price as low as possible. The third one is natural gas vehicle, but it hasn't been that much supported by the Obama administration. And the fourth one would be increasing the switching from coal power generation to gas. And here we see a lot of opposition to LNG exports from Democrats, which fear that more will have gas dedicated to LNG exports, less will be left for the domestic market in the U.S., and it could decrease the coal to gas switching in power generation. So we see that all those sectors are in competition, and that's why we think that the Obama administration is going to move very slowly, especially this year, which is an election year, in not approving too many and too fast LNG projects for exports. So we've seen already one big project, the Sabine Pass project from the Gulf Coast, that has already received the DOE authorization to export everywhere. And the project is well advanced. They have already four long-term agreements, one with BG, which is a portfolio supplier, another one with Gas Natural, another portfolio supplier, and then two state-owned companies. One is GAIL from India, and the other one is KOGAS from Korea. So it was interesting to see that no Japanese company had taken the risk to buy yet U.S. LNG. But one of the reasons could be that Cheniere, the company that is promoting the Sabine Pass project, has a very low credit history, a lot of debt, and historically Japanese buyers are more in confidence when the partner has good credit history. But also, Japanese might be more interested in Canada. All the Canadian projects are in British Columbia, facing Asia, and it's only about 8 shipping time distance from Japan, which is a critical argument. But all those Gulf Coast projects are going also to be focusing and targeting Asia, because by 2014, the Panama Canal is going to be expanded to receive about 80% of the LNG fleet. So this is a critical advantage for all those Gulf Coast projects, because basically it reduced by half the shipping distance from the Gulf Coast to Asia. Also, another big argument in advantage of those Gulf Coast projects is that they are already half built, because they used to be regasification facilities. So they only have to build a liquefaction processing plant, but they already have the storage tanks and the jetties. They have already the location in place and so on. So just on the political risk issue, I don't think the Department of Energy would revoke any authorization once they have granted it. And for the projects which have still a pending authorization for non-FTA countries, like Freeport, in which Japanese customers have shown interest, for example, and that could be also an option for Japanese buyer, because you know those projects are not going to start before 2016, 2017, or 18. And by that time, Japan may have already become a free trade partner under the Pacific Trade Agreement. So that's something also to consider. Or Japanese buyer could have an agreement with the United States to get a waiver or some kind of agreement that way. Yeah.
Great. Thank you so much, Leslie. Just to be fair to Commissioner Magowit, if I may ask a very quick question. So many of the Mr. Tanaka illustrated in sort of a scene setter, there are more countries in Asia, non-OECD Asia, and also probably Middle East that are interested in nuclear power generation. What role, if any, can the United States NRC regulatory body, US NRC play in guiding or advising to improve the safe operation of these plants?
Well, it's certainly a question we hear quite often, because there are many countries that do not currently have nuclear infrastructures that have expressed interest in building new nuclear power plants, including countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, and Southeast Asia. And I think the words you used were really quite accurate. We are available to countries of that nature to provide advice, to provide some input to their, as they develop their processes. But I think it's always important to recognize that nuclear regulation is a very domestic business, and each country has to develop its own approach to nuclear regulation. And I think that while the international community can provide assistance of a technical nature, the decisions have to be made in each country. But as these countries do move down that path, we do have active programs in place to give them advice and to provide technical assistance where requested, and we provide whatever we can as their consideration goes forward.
Thank you so much. So let's open the floor for the gentleman in the blue shirt right there.
Hi, thank you to all the presenters. Dean Gerdes, I'm with Down East LNG, a CEO, worked in the sector for about 20 years. A couple of points and clarifications. That EIA number of 54% applies to 12 BCF of export, which isn't going to happen. That's a lot of, that's 20% of current demand. So more realistic numbers, I think, have put the price impact at 10 to 15 cents. One question, or two questions. One, Cheniere is approved, that's correct, but it hasn't gone on the FERC docket yet. It was supposed to be, they were hoping to schedule it last week. It wasn't scheduled. Any thoughts of the delay is political? Who knows? I don't know. The next question is the bilateral agreement, or the interest on the Japanese to have a bilateral agreement on LNG with the DOE. Is that realistic? Do you think that could occur, or is that, I know they had one on the original export project in Alaska some back in the 69, 70 when it first started. Because I think that's one of the barriers to the Japanese wanting to commit, is because of the political risk associated with that. Thank you.
On the FERC permitting process, that could be political. I think this year we're going to see a very slow path of decision on the LNG export front, just because it's an election period and it starts to become so political. You know, you have the opposition from the industry, from consumer groups, from Democrats, all fearing an impact on the U.S. domestic price. So I think we'll have very slow decisions. But the Cheniere project had already received the FERC approval for its regasification terminal. So the FERC approval for the export facility is supposed to be an easy one to get.
Well, as you expressed very correctly, yes, this is a political process, so I cannot say how easy the Department of Energy gives the approval once the Japanese company puts the request. But the Japanese government is very serious and, I would say, forthcoming of asking that this kind of option, if open for Japan to import the American LNG, helps the domestic situation very substantially. So we are a good alliance partner, and I strongly believe that once that situation happens, that a favorable decision will be given for the exportation to Japan.
Thank you. We only have 5 minutes to go, so maybe I can just take two questions and then ask the, so you, sir, and then there, Sam. Yes.
Out of my throat. I'm Charles Newstead from the State Department, and I would first say to Madam Gutzman that she gave an excellent presentation. I was very impressed, and I predict a brilliant future for you. Now, but more importantly, I want to turn to Commissioner Magwood and ask him something about nuclear, because I'm much more concerned about what's happening in China. We're going, as you know, really still going gangbusters on building reactors, and there's some question about what their safety culture is, but I don't think it's going to be turned down by Fukushima. So I'm sure that the Chinese, that just me personally talking, not the State Department, but I'm sure the Chinese are going to build lots and lots of reactors, nuclear reactors, as they've claimed. And the question will be then, if they do that, what sort of possibility would there be for exporting that power to Japan if Japan decides not to have a strong program? That could also be a question for Mr. Tanaka. So that two questions. There's one question for the commissioner, and then the other final question is, I agree with you on power blackout, which I think is the most, or station blackout, which is the most frightening condition of all. And although we've got fairly strong safeguards against that, it still isn't 100%, and I'm wondering what we're doing and what the Japanese authorities are doing to safeguard their diesel generators.
Thank you. And Sam, maybe a quick question.
Sam Lederer, Federation of Electric Power Companies of Japan. Thank you all the participants for your presentations. My question is also for Commissioner Magwood. Are there any lessons from the NRC's growth as an independent agency after 1974 for Japan's creation of its own independent regulator right now? Were there any bumps in the road or great successes from those early years that could be used in Japan? Thank you.
Feast and famine, apparently. By the way, I was also hoping to hear something good about my future, but since you since you offered none, I'll refrain from asking. First on China, I think that you know, many people have raised this issue because the Chinese are building at a very rapid rate. They have slowed down a bit to take a breath after Fukushima. Everyone I've talked to in the last year indicates that the Chinese leadership has taken the Fukushima incident very seriously and has reinforced the message that safety is paramount. And I think that is clearly seeing the effects that Fukushima Daiichi has had on Japan. There's obviously a huge incentive to make sure that doesn't happen in China. So it's certainly been reported to me, and it's certainly my hope that the lessons of Fukushima are learned around the world, not just in China, but really in all countries that consider building new nuclear power plants. I'll defer to Mr. Tanaka on the export issue. I have heard about this Asian super grid idea, but I'm not, that's outside my expertise. Regarding the question about lessons, it's an excellent question, and one of the reasons I backed up to talk about the Atomic Energy Commission is because if you go back in history, you will see organizations much like the Atomic Energy Commission that were sort of sprouted up around the world. You know, many agencies that deal with nuclear power were structured to look somewhat like the AEC. And I think that in the case of Japan, there was still up until very recently the thought that you could both regulate and promote nuclear regulation in the same organization. And the big change in the United States to separate those was done very consciously, very visibly, with a great deal of force to make sure that the cultures were very separate, and they are. If you talk to NRC people, the culture is very, very different from the DOE people. So I think that that's part of the lesson that Japan has already absorbed. As you probably know, the decision has been made to shift NISA, the regulator, from METI to the Ministry of the Environment. That's certainly a good step. But I think that one difference that between the U.S. and Japan that makes this difficult is that since Japan operates in the parliamentary system, it's very difficult to get decisions made outside of a ministerial context. In the United States, we have independent agencies. We have a history of independent agencies that work outside of those sorts of chains. You know, for example, NRC, a lot of people internationally are surprised when I explain this, but you know, NRC commissioners don't actually report to anybody. We don't report to the president. We don't report to a minister. We really are independent, and we make decisions based on what we think are the right things to do. And that's a rarity around the world, and it's very difficult to replicate that in a parliamentary system. But I think there are things you can do to build as much independence as possible, and we have had conversations like that with our Japanese colleagues.
Thank you for the question about this issue for the exporting electricity from China to Japan. It's an interesting idea. I mean, in the IEA ministerial meeting some time ago in October last year. Yes, I asked a question to many of the ministers whom I'm familiar with, including Stephen Chu. Do you want Japan to continue nuclear power? Everybody say yes. Why not? We need Japan to continue nuclear power and make it safer by sharing the lessons of Fukushima. And by doing so, the nuclear power generation could be safer in the future. So that's a very encouraging statement. And I think this could apply to this China situation. If China is taking a breath, as Commissioner said, and considering to move rather to the second generation reactors to the third generation. And that's a good thing, to make the power generation safer. And by maintaining the safer operation in Japan, it certainly helps our neighbors to be safer. And by exporting the technology or by building the plant in these countries and export the electricity back to Japan, that's also a possible option in the future. Not yet the plan, but I think that kind of operation also helps Japanese utilities be more competitive. Japanese utilities has been limited their scope only in their monopolized region or market and never be competitive. So I think by doing so, you know, so we could have more competitive utilities with better technologies and management. So that's for that sake, in this kind of intertwined or integrated electricity market is a very interesting future of the Asian region. For the independent commission thing, yes, in Japan, yes, unfortunately, until recently, that promotion agency, METI, owns part of this regulatory system. And IEA has been warning also that because two of these different entities be there, Japanese energy security, nuclear security is sometimes excessive requirement. To prove they are safe, yes, sometimes they have to do more than safe, scientifically safe operation. So convince public, we say it's anshin, not anzen. That is more the emotional or political security concept is required, and it's more costly. So can we reconcile this excess or over-regulation to the fact that Fukushima incident happened? It's difficult. Probably the focus of the security or safety was wrong in Fukushima Daiichi. And that's another very interesting lesson that we need very objective scientific process as close as possible to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in the United States in the future. Well, I think in the current circumstances, building new power plant in a new site is probably very difficult. But replacing old reactors with newer and much more safer reactors could be possible option. So I am not that pessimistic that reactors could never be built in Japan. I mean, I think it's feasible, but it takes some time to convince the public because this is a so-called probably credibility crisis of the Japanese government. We lost total trust of the public. So we need good help of the international organization like IAEA or U.S. National Regulatory Commission in a peer review or whatever the process to see what the Japanese situation is going to be. And that gives this kind of foreigner's view or international standard, global standard view helps to convince Japanese public to accept the future of the reactors. And that's the reason why, I mean, I'm very happy that Commissioner Magud come to Japan in April in our in a very important forum of nuclear future and help us to convince Japanese public that this is necessary and also it's possible.
Well, thank you very much I'd like to thank the speakers as well as the audience for an excellent session. Please join me in thanking them.